From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moskowain with Fresh Air. Rivethead maybe isn't the nicest thing one person can call another, but it's what Ben Hamper's co-workers called him during the 11 years he worked on the assembly line at General Motors. Now he's written a first-person account of those years on this edition of Fresh Air, talking with Rivethead. Also today, reporter Stryker McGuire on covering Central America on Deadline for Newsweek magazine, and returning to Central America to check out life without his reporter's notebook. And film critic Stephen Schiff checks out a pair of new comedies. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moskowain. For more than 10 years, Ben Hamper spent his days on the assembly line at the General Motors plant in Flint, Michigan. He assumed he'd be there for life, just as his father and grandfather had been. But Hamper discovered he had another talent. After work, he began jotting down observations about life on the line, and when he sent a record review to the local alternative paper, they printed it. Turns out the editor was Michael Moore, who would go on to direct the GM-bashing film Roger and Me. Moore felt the review was so wonderfully sick that he offered Hamper his own weekly column. Impressions of a Rivethead, named for one of Hamper's jobs on the line, became one of the most popular columns in the Flint Voice. Now Hamper's tales from the assembly line have been collected in the new book, Rivethead. Here's Hamper reading from the first chapter.
I was 7 years old the first time I ever set foot inside an automobile factory. The occasion was family night at the old Fisher Body Plant in Flint, where my father worked a second shift. General Motors provided this yearly intrusion as an opportunity for the kin of the workforce to funnel in and view their fathers, husbands, uncles, and granddads as they toiled away on the assembly line. If nothing else, this annual peep show lent a whole world of credence to our father's daily grumble. The assembly line did indeed stink. The noise was very close to intolerable. The heat was one complete bastard. Little wonder the old man's socks always smelled like liverwurst bleached for a week in the desert sun. For my mother, it was at least one night out of the year when she could verify the old man's whereabouts. One night a year when she could be reasonably assured that my father wasn't lurching over a pool table at the patio lounge or pickling his gizzard at any one of the thousand beer joints out on Dort Highway. My father loved his drink. He wasn't nearly as fond of labor.
You write that before visiting the automobile plant, you thought that your father built cars all by himself. When you first saw an assembly line, what was your reaction?
Actually, I was quite terrified. Because I'd never seen anything like this. It was so huge and enormous and noisy and filthy that I actually felt, sorry for my father. You know, I just assumed that he went to some glitzy little garage and, you know, built the cars out of kits or something, you know.
So what you saw then was a real glimpse into...
My future.
Into your future, your father's present and your future.
Mm-hmm.
What did GM do to make families, or to try to make families, feel part of the company?
Not much, I guess, you know. Once a year, I think they let the families come through. And, of course, they were all under the umbrella of the wonderful GM benefits package. But... Otherwise, I don't really know what else they did.
Was GM able to create some kind of identity or even a sense of loyalty for the people that worked there?
In Flint, Michigan, certainly, yes. It was a family tradition, you know. I'm a fourth-generation shop rat, or was. And it was just handed down from, you know, generation to generation. Your father would get you an application once you got out of high school, and you'd sign up, and it was just like going in the Army, you know. Well, except you went in for 30 years.
It was the only game in town, too, wasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. In Flint, if you don't work for GM, I mean, you pump gas or you flip burgers or you just sit by railroad tracks and, you know, watch the sun come up and go down.
You describe being part of this generation of shop rats, your father, your grandfather, aunts and uncles, and a whole extended family. How did you resist General Motors?
How did I resist it initially?
Yes.
Well, I got out of high school, and I was just bound and determined. I thought, you know, I was very cynical, and I had this naive belief that, you know, I was somehow talented and you could do more than just put a screw in a hole. And so I wasted about 3 prime earning years with that belief in near poverty before I realized that I was kidding myself. And I was painting apartments for like minimum wage, and I already had a wife and daughter, and it came time to pay the bills, and so I opted to sign on the dotted line.
When you first started working for General Motors, you were assigned to the cab shop, which was known as the Jungle. Can you describe what it was like, your first day on the job?
It was very terrifying. They led us up to the Jungle, which is on the second floor, where they do all the welding on the cab bodies. And there's sparks shooting everywhere in every direction. And people are MIG welding and spot welding and brazing. Just lots of heat, noise, fire, and, you know, the overall claustrophobia of all these wires hanging down and huge cables looping everywhere. It was just, to me, a horrific scene. And I remember that first day I hired in, I said, well, what I'll do is I'll make it to the end of this shift, and then it's bye-bye. I'm going to look for something else. Maybe I can still become a disc jockey or something.
You describe the noise, and you say it's like it was like some hideous, unrelenting tape loop of trains having sex. I almost know what you're talking about when you write that.
I like that line. If you really think of it, that's what it was like. Imagine trains having sex, you know, if you can possibly imagine that. Going on for like 8 hours a day, and that's about what it was like.
I noticed, too, on your first day on the job that the foreman or the overseer called you boys. Was that what bosses called workers, boys?
Some did. This guy happened to. You know, I didn't take any, you know, personal affront to the thing. Sometimes they called you. Well, I can't say it here. Is this a family radio show? I mean, everything from... A lot of times they referred to us as bodies. I didn't like that. Like some department would be short a few workers on a Friday because guys didn't come into work on Friday or something, and the foreman would shout out, hey, we need a couple bodies over in, you know, the axle line. You know, I thought, ooh, bodies.
Hmm. You know. You didn't think of yourself as a body.
Well, you know, when I think of a body, I think of a cadaver, you know. And of course, a lot of us, you know, felt like cadavers in there sometimes.
Ben Hamper is my guest, and he worked on the GM assembly line and has written a book about those years, and they were from 1977 to 1988. The book is called Rivet Head, Tales from the Assembly Line. Reading about your book, it sort of reminded me a little bit of what you also seem to describe as your Catholic education.
Yeah, there's similarities.
Can you tell us more about that, those similarities?
Jeez. Well, outside of the fact that, you know, I never swallowed a lot of the stuff that the nuns crammed down my throat, and I never swallowed a lot of the hokey bunkum that a lot of the supervisors like to cram down our throat. That was probably the biggest, you know, parallel.
So you never went for it?
No, no. You know, it was actually demeaning at times. I write about... our implant mascot. They actually dreamt up a mascot for us, which was this like 5'6" gigantic kitty cat named Howie Make'em. And it was a guy in a cat suit with a large huge, enormous cat head with whiskers and a cape with a Q on it that stood for quality. And he'd romp around, come down the aisles, just like, you know, it was a football game back in junior high, you know. And you know, that kind of stuff was just preposterous and demeaning after a while. We ran with the joke at first, but, you know, it just, it really, when we thought about it after a while, we said, oh, my God, this is what they think of us, you know, that we're just these zombie nitwits, you know, that can only relate to, you know, cartoon character figures or something.
After working in the cab shop, you went to the rivet line, and you said that it kind of got into your blood. You got a certain satisfaction out of doing the rivets. Tell us what you did.
Well, I had a couple different jobs down there, but they both revolved around riveting pieces of equipment onto the frame. But I just had this sick fascination with rivets and riveting. I enjoyed it. I really did. I enjoyed the feel of the rivet gun. It was powerful and strong, and I just became so proficient with it that I could twirl it and make it do everything I wanted, and it was just like a third arm to me. And I really prided myself on being probably the best riveter in the world, and hence one day I realized I was the quintessential shop rat and the greatest riveter in the world, and I so deemed myself rivet head. This all happened in the span of about 30 seconds, and there were no news bulletins about the occasion at all.
And hence the name of your book, of course.
Yes.
You also write about watching the clock. I mean, the almost the torture of watching the clock during the day. How did it haunt you, just the passage of time?
Oh, it would just crawl because, you know, they'd have clocks stationed everywhere. I think it was just sort of a sadistic gesture on GM's part to put all these clocks everywhere. And if you got in the habit of doing your job and then sitting down waiting for the next job to come and staring at that clock, you would swear that thing was not moving, not budging, and time would go so slow. I've often said, and I'd like to repeat here, that my main gripe was not with GM, is with their clocks, is with the clock. That was our enemy. It wasn't General Motors, you know. General Motors, you know, they were culprits in a lot of stupid buffoonery, but those clocks were our main enemies, and making them move was our goal each day through any kind of diversion we could think up.
Would you have been better off without a clock?
Certainly, I think so. I mean, most guys wore watches anyway, but at least with the watch you could sort of control it. I can remember, I will not look at my watch, you know, for what I think will be an hour. And then I would think an hour would pass, and I'd look at my watch, and like 9 minutes passed, and I would go, oh, my God.
Ben Hamper is my guest, and he's written a book called Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line. It's about his years as a shop rat, an auto worker on the assembly line at General Motors Truck and Bus Plant in Flint, Michigan. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Ben Hamper is my guest. His book is called Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line. When did you begin to write for the Flint Voice?
I believe somewhere around 1980, 1981.
And it was Michael Moore that...
Yeah, Michael Moore. He was the editor of the paper, and we had met, and we became friendly. And at first, I wasn't writing at all about the shop, but he kept edging me in that direction, always telling me that he thought that would be a very, very good thing in this town in Flint, Michigan. People would be interested in, and I resisted. But finally I gave in. I started writing the column called Impressions of a Rivet Head biweekly, and it proved to be probably the most popular thing in the paper and generated more mail and everything else than anything else. So we stuck with it, you know. Mama didn't raise no, you know, dunce, you know. I just, you know, grabbed the golden udders and kept them milking, you know.
You had an ongoing or an open-ended invitation to Roger Smith, who was head of General Motors, to go bowling with you. Were you truly serious?
Oh, yeah. I really was. You know, to me, and I still don't understand GM completely, they have no sense of humor or anything. They would pipe up all the time about how management and the workers had to come closer together to, you know, to smash down these walls of animosity, and, you know, we're all one team and this and that. And so here I am extending in my column quite often the invitation for Roger Smith and me to go bowling some Friday night, like, say, a guy would at a gas station with his boss, you know, just to prove, and this would have gotten just incredible PR, you know. I can imagine all the networks there to see, you know, and I was offering, no one else was offering to do this, so I took it on myself, the rivet head, you know, bowling with Roger Smith, and it'd be a very friendly thing, and, you know, no wagering. We would just, you know, he'd drink his scotch, and I'd drink my pitcher of beer, and, you know, it didn't matter who would win, you know. It wasn't a challenge, you know, like, hey, we can beat you, you know. We represent the workers, and we represent, you know, management. But they never followed through, but then again, you know, they're always known for shooting themselves in the foot.
What do you think Roger Smith and others' idea then of developing this sense of purpose and comradeship? How did they do it? Was it just these once a year kind of family invitations to the factory? Or did they have other things that they did too?
I'm not aware of any other things they did, no. A story I do have to show you sort of where Roger was at with his relationship to his, you know, millions of underlings. One day, he was scheduled to come to our plant, the Flint Truck and Bus Assembly Plant, to view these new military vehicles. We had just finished the first batch of them, and he was going to show them off to some admirals or some generals or something. And everyone was very excited by the fact that he was going to show up that day, and we thought, you know, he'll probably be walking down the aisle with bodyguards and waving, and we were all quite excited. We were going to see the head honcho, you know, the chairman of the board, B-O-R-E-D. And sure enough, like 3 hours into the shift, the foreman came around informing us that we were all being sent home. And I asked the foreman why. And he says, well, no particular reason. I said, well, is there a shortage of parts? Is there a breakdown? No, no. We're just sending you home today. And then it dawned on me finally that they were sending us all home so Roger wouldn't be polluted with the sight of all of us shop rats, you know, dirtying up the atmosphere. I really took umbrage, and I was really, really angry about the whole situation after that, and I wrote about it because, you know, what was a factory without factory workers? How did trucks get assembled without assemblers? And what they were doing was kicking us out so when Roger came through the plant, it would all be sterile and quiet, you know. Not a real factory.
How would you improve things there? What would you do?
I don't know. I don't know. I think I would have a system where the jobs got rotated so people weren't stuck on the same job for years and years and years, you know, and just, you know, rotted away on these things. And a guy couldn't just keep one job that was really good while his neighbor worked his butt off three times as hard and got paid the same amount of money. I would rotate jobs like every 6 months, you know. And I'd also smash the walls down and put in windows.
There are no windows?
No, there are no windows, you know. And you never tell if it was day or night or raining or sunny, you know. And I remember a couple times they had tornadoes go by and we didn't even know about it. We'd get out of the shop and, you know, it's so noisy in there, you know. We'd turn on the radio driving home and, yes, the tornado that went right through near the GM truck and bus plant 4 hours ago. We're going, what? Tornado? So that was the noise up on the roof, huh?
Ben Hamper is my guest. His book is called Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line. It's about his years working on the assembly line at the General Motors truck and bus plant in Flint, Michigan. You had a nervous breakdown. Is that right?
I wouldn't
Would you call it that?
No.
What would you call it?
I had a series of very severe panic disorder episodes.
What do you think they were caused by?
To this day, I have no idea. You know, it came out of the clear blue, and I'm sure they were exacerbated by my... is that the right word? Oh.
I think
so. That's like a five-syllable word. Well, I think they were exacerbated by my working at GM because it lends itself to a very claustrophobic environment. And like I said earlier, the shot began to wear on my nerves. People seemed stacked, you know, too close together. There were no windows. It was so noisy, you know, and I just got this feeling of suffocation after a while. And one night it all broke loose on me. It was just an average shift, and I was on break, and I was reading the sports page, and everything just went totally crazy. My heart went beating crazy. My arms tingled, my legs tingled. My vision went all to hell, and I immediately left the plant. And a few days later, saw a doctor when this started to reoccur, and was soon put in a mental health clinic where you saw me and Roger and me, and was diagnosed as having panic disorder.
When was the last time you had one?
About 4 minutes ago. No. When they told me I couldn't have another cigarette. No, I don't know. You know, I still have anxiety attacks and stuff. A full-blown panic attack, it's been a while, a couple months, you know. But, you know, I don't blame this. I don't put this at the foot of GM because I would also experience these things like in shopping centers, at red lights, you know, standing in line to buy razor blades. So.
You left GM, but I wonder how much you've been able to get it out of your system.
It's been difficult because I had planned to work there. Of course, I'd be laid off anyway, as it turns out. But, you know, I had planned to, I had a good thing going. You know, I was making good money. And I had just gotten remarried, so I obviously needed money. Money. And, you know, it was entwined with the thing I was starting to love, my hobby, this writing thing. So I had so much vested in returning to GM. But I was just unable to do it. And finally, the doctor that I was seeing just disallowed it, said, look, you've had it. I'm not going to send you back there anymore. And it was just sort of a farewell to arms and legs and toes and, you know, all the things that get chopped off in rivet guns.
Can you make a living on your writing? Is that where you're putting your energies now?
Yeah. I don't know how to do anything else. Not that I know how to write, but I think I did a good job on Rivethead. It's generating a lot of response, positive reviews, and hopefully that will lead to another book contract that we're already discussing.
So you're not a shop rat, you're a writer now?
Yeah, unfortunately. I like to do both, but I can't. So.
Well, I thank you very much, Ben Hamper, for joining us today on Fresh Air.
I've had fun. It's been a privilege.
Ben Hamper's new book is called Rivethead, Tales from the Assembly Line. I'm Marty Moss Cowain, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moss Cohen with Fresh Air. When events in Nicaragua started to heat up in the late 70s, Newsweek magazine sent reporter Stryker McGuire. After years of covering Latin America for Newsweek, McGuire took some time off from the magazine to see Latin America for himself. Coming up, he shares his impressions. Comedians Martin Short and John Candy are both veterans of the SCTV comedy series, and they're both starring in new movies. Short as the world's biggest klutz in Pure Luck, and Candy as a hallucinating scriptwriter in Delirious. Film critic Stephen Schiff has reviews of both films. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. In 1986, Stryker McGuire was doing well as a senior editor at Newsweek. His office even had a couch, when he decided to get out from behind his desk and travel. He had worked for Newsweek as a reporter in Latin America in the late 70s before he became an editor at the home office. But 3 years of editing foreign correspondents had left him restless. Now it was time to go back to Latin America, but this time as a tourist. He recalls his 20,000-mile journey driving from North America to the end of South America in his new book, Streets with No Names. I asked him when and why he first went to Central America.
The first time was in 1978, and I went to Nicaragua. I was working in Los Angeles at the time for Newsweek, and we didn't have a Mexico City bureau at that time. The only bureau we had in Latin America, in fact, was all the way down in Buenos Aires, which, needless to say, is a long, long way away from Central America. And Central America really hadn't been on people's minds here in the United States anyway. When this group of rebels called the Sandinistas took over the National Palace in Managua, Nicaragua, and I was in Los Angeles, I spoke Spanish, and they sent me.
Did that make you somehow an expert then?
as close as these things go, you know, sometimes in fact it is language and the, you know, conviction by somebody that you can actually report is enough to get you sent to a place which really hasn't really been on anybody's radar screen.
How soon before you felt you could write with some degree of authority about what was going on in Nicaragua?
With authority?
Yes.
6 months.
And how soon after you got there did you have to start writing about Nicaragua?
2 days. So you can imagine there's obviously a great gap between the two. You can write without making errors. You can write without making bad judgments. You can write without really fouling up. In a very short period of time, but with authority, to me, conveys something altogether different.
Did you feel like a faker?
No.
Why not?
Because I did know something about the country, and before I went down there, I read even more. The other thing is that in the business that I'm in, and especially the business that I was in 1978, that is to say, the kind of journalism I was doing was really, you know, it's not in-depth journalism. What we were doing back then is basically reviewing for people the events of the previous week. And in order to do that with an event like a hostage-holding siege, you don't, frankly, have to be an expert on Nicaraguan history. You have to know something. But you don't have to be an expert.
Did you find yourself fighting to keep some sense of either distance or objectivity when you were covering a war in Nicaragua? Is there something about a war that makes journalists have to I don't know, hold off a little bit about their emotions.
Well, there is, especially a war like the Civil War in Nicaragua. I mean, it was plain to most of us who were there that the previous 50 years of Nicaraguan history, which had basically been sponsored by the United States and had been well, the rulers were three Somozas over stretching over two different generations. There was no doubt about the public desire, the public enthusiasm for their departure, and in a war like the one in Nicaragua, we had very, very few restrictions. Frankly, they tried to impose some, but mostly to ludicrous effect. Really, we could go back and forth between the two sides, so it wasn't that reporters were confined, for example, to be with, say, Somoza's, Anastasio Somoza's National Guard troops. In a situation like that, I think even if you disagree with the hierarchy of a country, if you were to spend a lot of time with the soldiers, I think, and I mean weeks and weeks or months and months, I think you would begin to identify with them. But those of us who were down there were crossing back and forth on a daily basis, crossing the lines, going back and forth, talking to the people, talking to the guerrillas, talking to Somoza's troops. And this in a way gave us a certain amount of objectivity because we were talking to all sides. But at the same time, we, for the most part, wanted the Sandinistas to succeed.
I'm speaking today on Fresh Air with Stryker McGuire. He covered the Nicaraguan Revolution for Newsweek magazine. He also served as Latin American regional editor and Mexico City bureau chief for Newsweek. He's currently chief of correspondents. He went back to Central and South America, not as a journalist, but as a traveler, and drove 20,000 miles around Central and South America, and has written a book about what he found there. The book is called Streets with No Names. We'll take a short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalist Stryker McGuire is my guest today on Fresh Air. His book is called Streets with No Names. When did you leave Nicaragua?
I left I've been there many times, but in that, if we're talking about my coverage of the Civil War, I left about 2 days after the Sandinistas took over, which would be that date is July 19th. 1979, and I left about 2 days later.
Why did you want to go back and to go back kind of without itinerary, without your badge of journalism, go back to this part of the world that you had covered as a journalist?
I wanted mainly to approach it differently. I wanted to be able to not do the kinds of things I was talking about earlier. That is to say, not have to report the day-to-day events. That takes a lot of time. It also distracts you from a lot of other things that are going on in the country. I wanted to go back basically as somebody who was passing through. I wanted to spend more time there, even though I had been in Nicaragua a long period of time. I wanted to see it differently, and you do see it differently when you're not writing everything down when you're talking to people.
As you traveled through Central and South America, how much evidence of anti-Americanism did you see? For instance, the Yankee go home signs.
I think anybody who travels through that part of the world would immediately be struck by the lack of it, frankly. It's always surprised me to find how little anti-Americanism there is that's directed at you and me and other people who are traveling through there. There's a lot of anti-Americanism in some of these countries that is directed at our government and our past governments, but toward individuals, it does happen. I mean, there's no doubt about it. It does happen, and you hear it, but it is not as strong as you would expect it from countries who have tremendous historical complaints against the United States. But not amazingly, I guess, because it's understandable, the people in these countries recognize that just as they should not be judged by their governments, which for the most part have not been great governments and have sometimes been awful governments, just as they should not be judged by their governments, the American people shouldn't necessarily be judged by its government.
That's an interesting distinction because our government supposedly represents us because we get to elect them.
That's right. That's right. I mean, I think if they thought it through fully, they should blame us. I mean, if they, for example, blame Ronald Reagan for the Contra War in Nicaragua in the 1980s, well, then they should also recognize that Ronald Reagan was elected twice by the American people, and it was not a fluke.
But they don't see that necessarily.
No, they really, you don't, you do get it, you get it occasionally, but especially if you're a person who is clearly not necessarily sympathetic, but willing to listen, if you're making an effort to talk to people in their language or in your own language, if you seem friendly, they will treat you it likewise.
Why was it painful for you to go back to Nicaragua, and you write about it?
Well, because it was such a wreck economically. Nothing worked. There was no money. The people were destitute, and it was just appalling to have seen what happened to that country. And part of it is the country itself has had an awful run of bad luck, beginning with an earthquake in the early 70s, and then the Civil War in 78, 79, and then the Contra War during most of the 1980s. It just, that kind of conflict over that period of time really takes its toll.
Let's talk a little bit about the contrast between Nicaragua and Costa Rica. And you describe a kind of dullness of Costa Rica in contrast to its neighbors, Connecticut with volcanoes. I don't know how Connecticut or even Costa Rica would feel about that.
Well, I must say I was talking about Connecticut before it was having all its horrible economic problems. So maybe now the Costa Ricans would not agree with that comparison. Costa Rica is this lucky country, and it's obviously it's not just luck. It's a lot more than that. But it has enjoyed democracy in a region that hasn't known much democracy. It's had it now for all of this century. It abolished its military after World War II, and doesn't even have a standing army at this point. It devotes a tremendous amount of its resources to education, even cultural events, the symphony and the ballet, and it's just not what we think of when we, in our kind of stereotypical way, think of a banana republic. And it was a banana republic, but it's a democracy.
Why do you think there's so little press coverage, I mean, relative certainly to Europe, of Central and South America? Kind of ongoing stories about what's happening.
Yeah, that will change someday. I mean, it has to, given the demographics of the United States. But it's something that has, it's been that way certainly as long as I can remember. I've fought that battle with some success, but for the most part, things haven't really changed that much. Why? I guess mainly it's because of what the people in the United States care about. And when you're talking about the people who actually sort of set matters of taste and style and journalism in the United States, you are, for better or for worse, talking mostly about people on the East Coast, and therefore the tremendous Hispanic influence in the southwestern United States is simply not really felt very much in our media. It's certainly felt more than it used to be, but not as much as it should be. When that changes, we will pay increasing attention to Latin America.
Thank you very much for joining us today on Fresh Air.
Oh, you're welcome.
Stryker McGuire is chief of correspondence at Newsweek and the author of a travel memoir called Streets with No Names. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered. What stories are you covering today, Noah?
Lots of news tonight, Marty, but I want to tell you about one special feature. I'll be talking with Willie Ruff. He's the author of a new book, talking with him about his life and career in music. He was born in Alabama. At age 14, he lied about his age and joined the U.S. Army. He was sent to Wyoming to be a truck driver at a base there. He had some musical talent, and somebody helped him learn to play the French horn. He left the Army later, went to teach at Yale. He played in Lionel Hampton's band. He's been teaching traveling, playing in a jazz duo ever since with his friend Dwight Mitchell. He believes music is storytelling, and tonight he demonstrates that.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. It's been almost a decade since the Toronto Second City television troupe called it quits, ending a comic dynasty rivaled only by the early casts of Saturday Night Live. Most of the SCTV graduates have wound up in the movies, but have any of them hit the comic heights they used to achieve so regularly on TV? Film critic Stephen Schiff has some thoughts on this after seeing SCTV alumni John Candy in the new movie Delirious and Martin Short in Pure Luck.
If in 1981 you had told me that 10 years later I would find the prospect of watching a new John Candy or Martin Short movie only slightly less nauseating than the prospect of watching Richard Simmons reruns, I would have thought you were crazy. In 1981, Candy and Short were two of the funniest people on earth, and the same might have been said for Andrea Martin, Catherine O'Hara, Eugene Levy, or any of the other SCTV lunatics. What went wrong? Several of them have all but disappeared from the comic ranks. Martin Short, meanwhile, makes terrible movies, even though he's always the best thing in them. Admittedly, he's a little hard to cast. He tried being a sci-fi hero in Inner Space, a good movie that flopped. He even tried playing romantic hero in the Marty-style comedy Cross Your Heart, a mediocre movie that flopped. The problem with Short is that he's too goofy to play the leading man in the standard Hollywood formula, boy meets girl, gets girl, loses girl. At the heart of his talent is his ability to go from nebbish to grotesque in the blink of an eye. One second he can play a wallflower, and the next he's a screaming meme. Unlike the oddly suave zanies who made it big after Saturday Night Live, the SCTV comics were dangerously short on sex appeal. They weren't smooth Chevy Chases or Steve Martins or Eddie Murphys. They were happy weirdos, a little too freaky for conventional love scenes. Still, Laurel and Hardy weren't exactly hunks either. Someone ought to be able to do better for Martin Short than Pure Luck, which is a pathetic remake of the slightly less pathetic French comedy The Goat. The premise is this. A tycoon's accident-prone daughter is missing in Mexico, and Detective Danny Glover can't find her. That's when the tycoon's advisor decides that if you find someone just as accident-prone as the daughter, maybe he'll stumble into the same black hole that swallowed her up. Martin Short, of course, turns out to be the guy who can't get near a door without slamming into it. And so he's hired. The tycoon even tells Short he's running the investigation. Glover will assist him. Which, of course, makes Glover crazy. Especially when Glover fails to recognize a suspect and Martin Short starts trying to reassure him.
I'll tell you something. I have problems recognizing people, too. Oh, sure. Yeah. Sometimes I'm walking down the street and I see a face reflecting in a store window. It takes me a second before I realize it's me. But the point of this is that you mustn't let it bother you. And you can be a great private eye and have bad eyesight. Anyway, you have a lot of other qualities. My goodness, you know, look how big you are. I wish I were half your size.
You are half my size.
Pure Luck is woefully logy and predictable, and yet Short is never anything but brilliant in it. You could say the same about John Candy in most of his movies, except that Candy seems to show up every couple of months in films so appalling that you forget whatever it was that made you love him in the first place. But wait a sec. I remember now. Candy was expert at playing glad-handing heels, MCs and lounge lizards who sweated a river projecting affability while their hands were rummaging around in your pockets. Candy's chuckling sleazebags were irresistible, but Hollywood fervently believes, with some justice, that you can't center a movie on a chuckling sleazebag. As long as Candy wanted to play a sidekick in a film like Splash, he could be the sort of wonderfully slobby cad he made his name with. But if he wanted that name above the title, and the big bucks that go with it, he had to file down the rough edges, which he promptly did. Now Candy plays feckless but lovable types, and his movies are syrupy and idiotic. The latest one, Delirious, at least has a funny premise. Candy plays a soap opera writer who bumps his head and wakes up living the soap he's writing. In fact, if he wants to write about how he drives a Ferrari, saves the heroine, and has every beautiful woman in the world slavering after him, that's what'll happen. Trouble is, a rival writer is working on the same soap, so Candy can never be sure who will be in control of the next plot twist. All of which would be fine if those plot twists weren't so uniformly lame and predictable. Delirious is so dull it makes Soap Dish look like the Philadelphia Story. Is there a solution to the SCTV slump? Only one I can think of. Since SCTV was a brilliant ensemble of supporting players, not really superstars, couldn't someone please bring them back together again so they could support each other?
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. The interviews and commentaries on Fresh Air are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, and Naomi Person, with help from Roberta Shorrock, Joan Tuohy, Susan Weinstein, Robbie Harris, and Sue Spolin. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Let us know what you think of Fresh Air. Give us a call on our listener response line at 1-800-NPR-WHYY. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
What if you were given the power of life and death? If you could create and destroy worlds, reshape the universe? What if you were given the power of God? That's just what happens to the hero of Robert Bausch's new novel, Almighty Me. Robert Bausch talks with us about heaven and earth on the next edition of Fresh Air.